From London, it's the Wired.co.uk podcast, episode 22 for Thursday, the 21st of April, 2011. On the show this week...
So we have these cutaway photos that show the magic view inside food while it's cooking. Pots cut in half, showing you carrots boiling or broccoli steaming, or a roast cut in half in the middle of roasting, showing you all of the various physics and chemistry things that are going on that contribute to the cooking process.
This week, we'll speak to Nathan Myhrvold, previously Chief Technological Officer for Microsoft and now founder of Intellectual Ventures, the company that's part think tank, part private equity firm, part VC investor, R&D lab and law firm. That's all coming up after we discuss the week in Wired News. Hello, I'm Nate Langson and I'm the editor of Wired.co.uk, and orbiting Planet Wired with me this week is senior staff writer Duncan Geer.
It is lovely to be back.
And our news editor Olivia underscore Solon.
Hi.
Duncan, you were away getting bitten by ticks the other week.
And eight ticks, to be precise.
What is it like to be bitten by a tick?
It doesn't hurt at all, because no. I think they have this sort of neuro-neutralizer thing. I should probably have researched this a little bit before the podcast, but they have some kind of poisony thing that numbs the area that they bite you.
That's incredibly considerate.
Yeah, I thought so too. Well, it's also more so that you don't go, ow, and flick them off immediately. Yeah. But then over time, they have sort of like drill-shaped mouthpieces, and they kind of drill into your skin and secrete this stuff that really, really sticks onto you. They're hard to remove.
I know there's a type of tick in the US that buries itself in dog's skin, and children pick them off, and they call them dog berries. So there's something you didn't know on a Thursday. Happy Easter, kids. And on that wonderful note, we're going to start talking about some news. Liv, you went to Oxford on Monday to meet with a whole bunch of people and learn something quite interesting about the BBC, right?
Yeah, I mean, the event I went to was the launch of the W3C UK office, which Tim Berners-Lee was kind of introducing and announcing. And one of the speakers was from BBC R&D, and he's a guy called Adrian Woolard. And they're obviously working to make more and more accessible forms of media for people with disabilities. And one of the kind of serendipitous byproducts of this...
Ooh, nice.
...is are that they can use the data that they create in providing these services to create really interesting visualizations and tools. I mean, one of the main things is looking at the subtitles which they create for deaf people.
Right, and there's a product called Channelography, right?
Exactly, and what this does is analyzes all those subtitles, all the words within those subtitles, and finds key topics and names and places. And it kind of crunches all this data to create really interesting kind of, you can work out how much people were mentioned over how long and which programs and the kind of, at the moment it's still very much a research project, but you can see that this kind of data being used in really interesting applications in the future.
So I know they've indexed this Channelography R&D project has indexed about 150,000 broadcasts of 70,000 episodes of about 962 shows, so just over 1,000 different programs from the iPlayer based on its subtitles. But this could help improve search in the digital public space, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think you can imagine being able to play around with the content in a much more interesting way. Pulling out, you could think of a topic or a place, and it would instantly be able to access all these different pieces of content and bring it together in some kind of hub.
It's the kind of thing that we would do some sort of info porn infographic in the magazine from, you know, how many times was, I don't know, the Palace mentioned this week on iPlayer.
Exactly.
I imagine it's about 7,000 mentions per second. I'm already pretty fed up of it. Duncan, you've been mute. Does this interest you at all?
What, the royal wedding?
I know your views on the royal wedding. You were just dancing around in a cape before we recorded this show.
In a Union Jack flag.
Yeah, I wasn't the only one. Let's be clear on that.
That's true.
I think this is a great idea, and I think it will also benefit the searchability of these programs. Mm. If you've got the entire... it kind of almost makes it so that you can almost like Shazam TV programs. It
absolutely
does what the gentleman from Shazam last week was talking about for BBC programs almost already.
Mm, exactly. So you could say, I want to find all mentions of this person or this actor or whoever.
Yeah, or who was it that said this quote?
Yeah,
bang,
and you could search the text and it would find it.
This is all really ties into the idea of making of achieving something that even Google has struggled to do over the last few years, particularly successfully, which is to index the content of videos on the services like YouTube. You know, it's very, very easy to search text, and it's increasingly easy now to search images, but it's much, much harder when you're talking about 30 images a second, for example, which is what would make up a video, or just under 30. Yeah. It's very, very difficult. So it's great to see something like subtitles, which are, you know, generally speaking, automatically, manually generated, yeah, being used to help index programs for various other uses than just broadcasts. So cool. On a slightly related note, although actually when I think about it, it's not related in the slightest. Duncan, you wrote a story earlier this week about Iran's head of economic affairs going on the record to say that Iran needs a Islamic edition of the internet.
Yeah, that's right. This is a chap called Ali Agha Mohammadi, who is Iran's, as you say, the head of economic affairs. And what he has suggested is that the country is going to try and create a parallel network to the internet, but one that conforms to Islamic principles, one that's halal.
So it's the idea is to avoid difficulties in censorship and things like that.
Yeah, because as we've seen, censoring the internet is pretty much impossible. So They've said, well, let's just start our own one instead.
And he said, Iran will soon create an internet that conforms to Islamic principles to improve its communication and trade links with the world. But what interested me even more, though, in this is the fact that one of the other goals is to make the Farsi language more prolific across the world, I guess, which seems counterintuitive when you're thinking about creating a secondary closed internet. It seems a bit bizarre.
I mean, what they would love is if the rest of the Islamic world adopted access to this network as well. And if that happened, and despite the fact that the Arab world mostly speaks Arabic rather than Farsi, It's possible that they could have some influence there. But in reality, this is an idiotic idea. This is just insane.
That's the thing. How's it going to improve communication and trade links with the world if it's essentially a walled garden, as you say?
That's the thing. And the idea of the internet is something that is open. It's universally adopted standards-wise. And it, now it doesn't matter what language you're speaking at all because the internet will support it. I mean, We even have Chinese character domain names coming into use. So, you know, the internet itself is already more, I don't want to say tolerant to other languages and things like that, but it certainly seems more beneficial to improving, say, the proliferation of language than creating a closed internet.
Yeah, and it's particularly interesting given the role that the web has played with democratic protests in the Middle East lately. You know, I think if they're trying to launch an independent network, that's presumably one that they can shut down as well, and I'm sure that that's not been far away from their thoughts.
Well, to be honest, that's not really been a problem with the current internet. I mean, during all the protests, they switched off the internet in Iran by essentially turning off all the ISPs. You know, which so there's not been a problem in censorship in Iran in terms of the internet. So I don't know. I mean, what else is quite interesting about this is that as early as 2004, Iran was the fourth largest country of bloggers in the world and is still extremely popular today. So it sort of does emphasize that this could have quite a big impact potentially on the rest of the net.
Well, except I think the entire rest of the net will just completely ignore it.
Well, they will.
I mean, there's no reason to replicate your content on yet another web and translate it into Farsi.
Look at what happened with AOL. They had a walled garden. What's AOL doing now?
Well, exactly.
I mean, not very much.
Is the idea that you would not then have access to the regular internet?
I think it would be both. It's more like an extranet.
In which case...
We haven't seen any technical specifications of how this would work, but if you think of it in terms of an extranet, it would be one that's governed in a similar way, I imagine, to how China controls its internet, which is the public internet, but it's strictly regulated by a giant great firewall of China.
Well, they haven't said anything about shutting off the regular internet in favour of this. And obviously, it's very early days. I have a feeling it might just be some minister spouting off with his ideas rather than anything more thought through than that. But
I think as well, you would find that a lot of the Iranian bloggers are blogging, and there's a lot of emphasis, obviously, on freedom of speech and getting what's happening in Iran out to the wider world. And I can't see why a closed off version of this would appeal to the people that have traditionally been so keen to get their message heard everywhere.
But what I can appreciate is the idea of creating content that conforms to Islamic principles, if that's, you know, what they're after. But I think a kind of parallel example is when Al Jazeera launched Al Jazeera English. It was aiming to kind of counter the Anglo-American skew that you might have seen in BBC News or CNN. So they created a channel in English so everyone who spoke English could actually access a news channel that was from a different perspective. And I think that kind of approach is probably better at in generating communication and links to the rest of the world.
Well, we'll have to see how it plays out. There's been no time given and no technical specifications, so it could be vaporware.
I wouldn't be surprised if we never heard anything about it ever again, to be quite honest.
But we will keep our eye on it, and if it comes into existence, then we will report its existence. Something that hasn't come into existence, but has been theoretically proposed as being possible, is that... that was great, wasn't it? A study from the University of St. Andrews has shown that planets in binary or multi-star systems, so that's a planet that has more than one sun, could grow black or grey vegetation as opposed to green. Duncan, you wrote this story, but I mean, space and astrophysics and stuff like this absolutely fascinates me. And this is just such an amazing thought that you could walk out of the door on one of these other planets, again, theoretically, and see a tree with black leaves.
Yeah.
How the hell does that work?
What you've got to kind of remember is that both plant life on Earth and our eyes have evolved to the wavelengths that are generated by our sun in the visible spectrum. And that is why... plants are green, because in coming through the atmosphere, you get lots and lots of blue light and you get some red light. And so once you've taken those out, once the chlorophyll in plants' leaves have absorbed those wavelengths, all that's left is green, and that's what gets reflected.
But what the PhD student who's involved in this research said that he said if a planet were found in a system with two or more stars, there would be potentially be multiple sources of energy available to drive photosynthesis.
That's right. So, but the stars would be different, and they wouldn't be radiating at exactly the same temperatures. So they're the wavelengths of light they emit would be different, and so the plants would have to adapt to one or the other or both.
That's what was amazing about this as well, that as a result of all this, plant life would either adapt to all of the suns or pick one. I mean, pick is a loose term, obviously, yeah. But it would respond to one of the suns or the other based on, I guess, how it evolved as a type of plant.
Yeah. I mean, I think the caveat you have to say here is that this is kind of, this isn't necessarily based on any data. This is more speculation. It's a bit of a thought experiment.
Yeah.
And in a situation where you've got multiple stars in a system, planets aren't likely to have your traditional circular orbit. They're going to have very, very complicated orbits that could take them far, far out of the habitable range for a very long time. And if you've got, for this to actually come true, they'd have to be within a habitable zone long enough for this vegetation to develop. And even then, they'd only be black trees to our eyes. You know, it's entirely possible that any animal life that evolves on these planets has eyes, if it has eyes, that respond to entirely different frequencies whatsoever, and it might look their equivalent of pink.
And we'd never know.
And we'd never know.
So what you're saying is we might not necessarily have to change the saying roses are red, violets are blue. It could be violet and blue on another planet.
Yeah.
But to us, it might be roses are black, violets are, I don't know, some kind of weird mousy blonde.
I think we should have more stories that just look
though,
as things that are theoretically possible. You know, there's possible that there's a teapot on the other side of the moon circling in an orbit.
I would happily talk about string theory for the entire duration of the show, but I don't think the show would be quite as popular. Although, interestingly, I was reading about the Crab Nebula in space, which is the result of a massive supernova sort of ages and ages and ages ago, obviously. But in around sort of 11th century, when this supernova was seen by people on Earth, it was so bright that you could read a book by it at night for months.
Wow.
You know, you could see it in broad daylight, you know, like almost like a second small sun. Anyway, coming up in a sec, we're going to be talking about who is the most loved and hated ISPs in the country, according to Ofcom. And also, what about renting a chicken for Easter?
Wired magazine, now published digitally every month on iPad. Download the interactive May issue, available now on the iTunes App Store.
Ofcom has done something for the first time, which is release data on the most complained about broadband providers, landline firms and mobile phone networks. Duncan, tell me about this.
That's right. The communications regulator totaled up all of the complaints it got between October 2010 and February 2011, and then assigned each one to each network provider to work out which providers were being complained about the most.
And Ofcom gets about 450 telecoms complaints every day from a range of issues like mis-selling and billing errors and stuff like that. And so they've basically released all this data to get the worst performers to be better performers, I guess.
Yeah, it's a kind of name and shaming exercise, I guess.
Right, yeah. So who do we think is the worst, although all three of us No. Who got the most?
Well, they split it up into different areas. So let's talk about broadband first. In when it comes to broadband, TalkTalk, which controls AOL and Tiscali, was by far the most complained about broadband firm. For every 1,000 of their customers, it gets 1.78 complaints for its phone service and 1.27 complaints for its broadband.
Okay, and how does that compare to someone like Virgin Media?
Virgin was the least complained about company. They only get 0.2 complaints per 1,000 customers. So Virgin customers are, on the whole, rather happier, it seems, than TalkTalk customers were over the time span.
Well, what was interesting about this is that when I first heard about this story, I thought it was just, well, TalkTalk is one of the biggest ISPs in the country. It figures that they would have more complaints. But that's not really how this works, is it? It's not to do with the number of customers.
It's split up per 1,000 customers. So, you know, as long as you've got multiples of 1,000, you're fine.
So what about mobile?
On the mobile front, Three beat out T-Mobile for the most complained about network. For every 1,000 customers, Three got 0.15 complaints, whereas T-Mobile got 0.13. So those were the least favourite. And it's interesting to note that that's much, much lower than broadband. Yeah. People tend to be complaining far less about their mobile phones than they do their broadband.
Yeah, people seem to be, as this story said, pretty chuffed with the service they receive. So that's kind of good.
But also, I guess this doesn't necessarily reflect the number of complaints about the service. It reflects the number of complaints that have got to the point where you go to Ofcom rather than your actual service provider.
Yeah, and in that case, it tends to be about much, much bigger issues rather than, you know, yeah, oh, my bill is wrong. It tends to be more about things like when T-Mobile changed its policy, its fair use policy about data usage earlier in the year, and it threatened to really slash the amount of data that its customers would get.
Might be that Virgin gets more complaints, but they just deal with them better so they don't move on to Ofcom
stage. Yep, that's true.
I have to say, Virgin, I'm a Virgin customer, and I've been pretty happy with their response.
Good generally, Twitter. If you respond well to your complaints, you're probably a company that isn't going to eventually get as many complaints.
So. Based on myself as a customer rather than a journalist, if I can get an answer over Twitter in 20 minutes about a problem, that's pretty good. So companies should be looking to do that.
Yeah, definitely. And of course, the vast majority of people actually are very, very happy with the service they get, or at least they don't complain about it.
Yeah.
Ofcom did a report in 2010 that said that 80% of broadband customers were completely happy with their service and 91% of mobile users were. So,
although, based on another study we heard about earlier this week, most of those people are spending too much on their mobile phone contracts. So they're happy, but they're being ripped off without knowing by their own fault. Anyway, if you have a view on any of this, do drop us an email, podcast@wired.co.uk. Be interesting to see if any of these results reflect your opinions. It's Easter, so we needed an Easter story, and Liv wrote about renting chicks.
Yeah, this isn't any kind of escort service that I've written about.
It's I'm not interested. Let's move on. No, go on. I'll let you go.
Come on. It's a Michigan farmer who is offering to rent out little pairs of fluffy Easter chicks for 2 week periods over Easter, so people can kind of practice or play at being a chicken owner
or a hen.
Or a hen, but then give it back at the end and not have to deal with the consequences of a gawky growing up chick looking less appealing and adorable.
I've seen what that happens in that episode of Friends where they had a chicken and a duck running around. It did not look like much fun. So what? So it's about, I think, $50, so 30, £31, something like that. You can get, if you're an amateur chick enthusiast, as you've wonderfully put in this story, you get 14 days worth of snuggling along with a pen, bedding and food.
As opposed to a professional chick enthusiast.
Yeah, well, if you're a professional, you'd own them. You wouldn't just be renting them. And then at the end of the rental period, you take the little chicks back and they swap it for a dozen eggs, which I find a little bit weird because then you're going to eat said eggs. And it's, I think there's...
Yeah, so you looked after the ones that didn't turn into your dinner.
Yeah, precisely.
I'm not quite...
But then they go off to then create your dinner because they go into the battery farm. It's not a battery farm. It's actually a barn farm, I think.
But this isn't the first time that this farm has done this, is it? They did it last year.
Yeah, and they rented out, well, it was 20 pairs of chicks, but sadly only 19 came back. So I'm not sure whether they were full-time adopted or whether they were loved to death by overzealous kids.
Or eaten by a cat, more likely.
Well, that too.
Yeah, that's quite possible. 19 pairs came out, so someone ran off with a pair of chickens.
Yeah.
I wonder where those chickens are now. Chicks.
Yeah.
Well, if you want to move to America and rent a chicken for 2 weeks, sorry, a chick,
then do.
Then now you know how. Before we move on to our feature for this week and leave chicken-related entrepreneurialism in the past. Duncan is incredibly excited about Portal 2 that came out this week.
Are you not excited at all?
Well...
You are brimming with excitement.
I'm massively excited. And
you've been drawing things on walls all day trying to push through them.
Okay, so I've had a copy of Portal for about a week now, and I have yet to be as excited about it as you. Tell everyone why they should be excited about Portal.
Okay, because...
Portal 2.
Portal 2, for three reasons. One, because it's a follow-up to a game that was absolutely incredible.
Not convinced. I mean, I'm convinced that that argument is accurate, but yeah, I'm not convinced that's the reason people should check it out.
Okay. Two, it is produced by Valve, and Valve have probably one of the best track records in gaming history for creating video games.
Half-Life, they bought Counter-Strike that made it awesome.
Left 4 Dead.
Left 4 Dead.
Team Fortress.
All that kind of stuff. Okay, yeah. Well, that's a good reason. And give me one third reason. You haven't mentioned my favourite reason.
What's your favourite reason?
Stephen Merchant voices one of the characters. I love
Stephen Merchant. Is absolutely incredible in it.
He is brilliant. It's an incredibly entertaining game. I mean, it's a game where... It's a puzzle game, basically, where you're trying to get through what is essentially a maze, and you have to shoot portals and walk through portals.
Yeah, it means you have to twist your head around all kinds of insane geometry. Mm. And it's one of these games where you feel incredibly stupid playing it until the moment when you work out the solution, then you feel like the smartest person in the entire world.
Liv, are you convinced?
Well, I haven't played it yet, but I'm going to be playing it this weekend, so I'm pretty excited about it. But I didn't play the first one, but I've heard so many good things from you guys about the game that I'm really keen to try it out.
If you've played it, we want to hear from you. Email us at podcast@wired.co.uk. We want to hear your thoughts about Portal.
Yeah, and if you think I'm right in thinking this is just them wasting time until Half-Life 3 comes out, seriously, Valve, get on with it. I've been waiting for that game since 2004.
There's hints in Portal 2 to Half-Life 3.
Okay, now
because they exist in the same universe, you see.
That's true. Yeah. Okay, well, we've talked enough about Portal. I want to move on to our feature this week, which was actually recorded for us by Tom Cheshire, who was interviewing Nathan Myhrvold a couple of weeks ago. And he brought in so many books, he needed a trolley, and they contained 2 kilograms of ink.
Great. So I'm here with Nathan Myhrvold, former Chief Technology Officer of Microsoft, founder of Intellectual Ventures. We ran a feature about that in the February edition of Wired, and now the author of Modernist Cuisine, a huge cookbook, which I can see in front of me. It's 5 volumes, beautifully illustrated. Is it 1,500 pages?
2,438 pages.
Wow. Okay.
18 kilograms. And my favorite statistic... about 2 kilograms of ink.
2 kilograms of ink. And it was literally wheeled in here on a trolley because...
Yeah, it's too heavy to lift.
Too heavy. Tell me about the book.
Well, the idea behind the book is to take a set of trends in cooking that have developed over the course of the last 10 or 20 years. That includes the emergence of science as an important thing for chefs. A guy named Harold McGee and many others have came up with the idea that science of cooking is relevant to chefs. As well as new technology, digitally controlled water baths, and other technological gizmos that allow you to cook with greater precision, ease, accuracy, and convenience than ever before. And finally, a new style of cooking that has been pioneered by chefs like Heston Blumenthal, Ferran Adria, and others that says, hey, we shouldn't just be able to cook the way our grandma cooked. We should be able to do some brand new things that may not have been possible before. And so all that work had gone on before this book, but it was very difficult to learn. It was very difficult to find it in any one place. And so the idea of this book is we cover the science of cooking, microbiology, physics, how computers can help cooking. We cover technique, and we also cover recipes. But recipes are less important to us than perhaps any other book. Most of all, we try to explain cooking. So we have these cutaway photos that show the magic view inside food while it's cooking. Pots cut in half showing you carrots boiling or broccoli steaming or a roast cut in half in the middle of roasting showing you all of the various physics and chemistry things that are going on that contribute to the cooking process.
Just speaking of that, the photography is amazing. How do you do that? It looks like a pot's been sawn in half. How do you do that?
We saw a pot in half.
Yes, great.
We've got a machine shop and... we saw things in half. The photos are pretty much straight photos. Sometimes we have to use a high-temperature silicone to glue a piece of Pyrex glass in front of a pot so it can contain a liquid while it cooks. Mostly, though, we make those pictures by making a hell of a mess. And cooking with half a pot, everything leaks all over the place, and it's a disaster, but you get a pretty cool picture.
That's amazing. And so did this start out as a hobby? So some of your other hobbies, like the collecting, discovering T-Rexes, is you've now discovered more T-Rexes than anyone else?
Our expedition has, yes.
Just as a hobby. Did this start as another hobby that got out of control?
Well, I've been interested in cooking my whole life. When I was 9 years old, I announced to my mother I was going to cook Thanksgiving dinner, which is a big thing in the States. I went to the library, got all these cookbooks, and by God, I cooked Thanksgiving dinner. And by my standards today, it wasn't so good, but I learned something, and I kept at it. Starting about 10 years ago, I really got into cooking even a more serious way than before. About 15 years ago, I went to a chef school in France just to, because I thought I took a leave of absence from Microsoft.
How did Microsoft do it?
It was really funny. I had to go into Bill Gates' office and tell him I wanted to take a leave of absence to go to chef school in France. And
did he take it well?
It was the first time anyone had asked. It was also the last time anyone ever asked. But he let me do it. And after leaving Microsoft, I had a little more time for cooking. And that's when I started getting into this more technologically oriented cooking. I realized there was a lot of information out there, but it was very inaccessible to people. So if I could create a big, definitive source book of everything, that might be useful.
And that's who you're saying that. So I've seen the pictures of the kitchen. It's this amazing technological marvel. Is there sort of 15 full-time people there?
Yep.
This doesn't seem to be aimed at sort of the average person, just sort of with a couple of pans.
Well, you know, it's aimed at someone who really loves food and is curious about it. And I think there's a set of people who are going to buy the book because they're curious about how food works, and they want to see those photos, and they want to learn things, and they may not cook a damn thing out of it, but that's okay. Curiosity and passion are enough. There are people who are home chefs who will buy it and they will cook from it. There already is a very enthusiastic community online on places like eGullet and elsewhere of everyday people that are out there cooking with a book. Finally, for professionals, it's a way to get up to speed on these state-of-the-art techniques, things that otherwise you'd have to take jobs at half a dozen restaurants and spend years learning. Are all printed out here in enormous detail.
Can we talk? So, what are the restaurants whose expertise you've drawn on?
Well, there's about 72 chefs around the world. Heston Blumenthal and Ferran Adria both wrote forewords to the book. They both have dozens of recipes in the book, but plenty of other folks have as well.
Cool. And so, is this cooking done for you now? What's next?
Well, right now it's doing what I'm doing now, which is talking to people about the book to get it better known and promote it a little bit. And then we're going to look at what our next project is. And we have a bunch of ideas. Well,
yeah,
let's
can you spill the beans on any of them?
Well, we haven't decided yet. So it's not a question of me not being willing to tell you. It's a question of I don't know yet. Awesome. But that's actually a wonderful state to be in. After I left Microsoft, there was this wonderful state of not knowing what I was going to do. And if you're a driven person that likes having goals, it's actually quite rare, delicious, and a little scary to not know what's next. So I'm not going to rush out of that phase. I'll savor it for a little bit.
Great. Well, I really look forward to seeing what next and what those ideas are. Thank you very much, Nathan.
Okay.
Cheers.
Thank you.
Thank you, Nathan, and thank you very much, Tom. That's going to be the end of our show for this week. Duncan, why don't you tell everyone how they can get in touch?
You can get in touch with us on Twitter. We are at Wired UK. Nyate is at Nyate Langson. Olivia is at Olivia_Solon, and I am at Duncan Gear. And you can also follow us on Facebook. On Facebook, we are Wired UK. And you should go and hit the like button and leave some comments on some stories. Do things like that.
And if you like competitions, you should definitely do that, because we're doing a bunch of competitions on Facebook at the moment. Yeah. Not right now, as you're listening, but generally speaking, we are.
Good
so,
tips.
You know, if you like generally speaking competitions, then whatever. Anyway, and finally, you should email us at podcast@wired.co.uk. Tell us what you think about the podcast. We would love to hear from you.
You should. And while you get on with that, we're going to go and have a happy Easter. So go and eat some eggs and rent chickens. And we will see you next week.
Bye.
Bye. We'll be right back.